Hello. Good evening, everybody. First, I want to thank the woman who put together this year and organized it and did all the research for the conference call. I want to thank Mrs. Middleman, Mrs. Fantle, and Mrs. Azran, Mrs. Moskowitz. Without them, this would not have happened. This is a little disconcerting to speak without having an audience in front of me. I usually am able to gauge my how well my shir is being received by the audience. I see if they're awake, if they're sleeping, if they're smiling, or if no one got the joke. In this situation, I'll just have to leave it to guesswork, but I would very much appreciate everybody's feedback. As I said on the email, you can text me with the number that's over there, or you can email me at rabbi@rmd.com. Please feel free to email me. I'll be waiting to hear some feedback about, you know, what if the shir's topic was interesting to you, other topics that perhaps you'd like me to talk about, questions on the topic, and so on and so forth. And I'll be happy to answer and discuss those as well. The structure of the shir will be as follows. The first 10 minutes we'll be discussing inyan of halacha. We'll talk about halacha that's pertinent to women in particular. We'll try to, you know, go from some Hilchos Shabbos, halachas that are relevant to taking care of children, chinuch. We'll try to discuss Hilchos Basar B'Chalav, kitchen halachas, you know, what to be concerned about, what to call a rav about, etc. We'll try to discuss Hafrashas Chala in no particular order. Again, we can go from any topic to any topic as per your request. I'll be waiting to see, and I will address them in that order. And of course, when it comes around the times of the different Yamim Tayvim, our shir will focus on the halachas of that particular yantiv. The second half of the shir will be on the parsha, and the point will be to talk about a topic that encourages discussion. The idea will be that this, through the questions that I raise and perhaps some of the ideas that I put forth, will be what to discuss and what to talk about by the Shabbos table, whether with your children or your guests or your husband. And it will be a good way to make the parasha real, you know, make it relevant and something to really think about. That's what I'm going to try to do. And again, here also, I'd appreciate your feedback about the direction that I'm going and, you know, what you think about the question and so on and so forth. Tonight, I want to discuss the very relevant halacha, which I get asked about frequently. What is the halacha about eating before Kiddush? And we're going to talk about what's the halacha about eating before Kiddush in the morning, Shabbos morning. Maybe next week we'll discuss what's the halacha of eating before Kiddush Friday night. But tonight we'll discuss about eating before Kiddush in the morning. So what we need to know, number one, is that Kiddush is unlike any other mitzvah. Whereas there are other mitzvahs where you're technically not meant and you're not supposed to eat before you do the mitzvah, but you can eat some things. You can drink water, you can drink other drinks, you can have a coffee, maybe you could eat a little mezainis, depending. But by Kiddush, you can't eat anything. You can't even drink water. Nothing. And the reason for this, the Paiskim explain, is because being that Kiddush is on Shabbos, everything we eat on Shabbos has a special importance to it. It's Shabbos food, regardless of what it is, regardless of what's prepared for Shabbos, even if it's a drink of water. It's Shabbos food, and they bring a source for this in a different area of halacha, a very interesting source. But regardless, the fact is that it's Shabbos food, and since it's so chashuv, therefore you cannot eat anything before Kiddush. You can't even take a drink of water. You could take a little water to swallow a pill, because that's not really called drinking. But other than that, you cannot drink or eat for anything before Kiddush. So if so, the question is, why is it that men wake up in the morning and they take a coffee before davening, or some eat a little bit before davening, or whatever, they drink soda? Why are they allowed to do that? You're not allowed to do anything. You're not allowed to eat or drink anything before Kiddush. So the answer is that the only time you aren't allowed to eat before Kiddush is when you are obligated to Kiddush. And the obligation for Kiddush is only when it's time to have the Suda. At the point when it's time to have the Suda, that's when you become obligated to Kiddush, and that's when you can't eat beforehand. Now, when is the time to have the Suda? You can have a Suda before you daven. At least a man can have a Suda before he davens, after. So therefore, the time for his Suda only begins after he's finished davening. So before davening, it's not the time to have the Suda, and therefore he's not obligated to Kiddush at that point. And therefore, he is allowed to eat. So that's okay. Now, what happens if there? You can have a situation where someone is not going to be davening. For example, someone is Loyaleno, he's sick, and he can't daven, and he needs to eat. He needs to eat a meal. So the Mishnah Berurah says that in that situation, what he should do is make Kiddush. He should not eat before he makes Kiddush. That's what Mishnah Berurah says. So if so, it raises the question, what about women? Women don't necessarily daven. Where, you know, maybe in a different share we'll discuss exactly if they are obligated or they're not obligated, but that's quite clear that a woman can't always daven. Very often she has busy with their children or whatever it is, and it's not possible, not feasible to daven. So at best, you know, she's lucky, she can get through Berachas HaShachar, and she can get through Brachas, maybe catch a Shema here or there, but that's about it. So she's not planning on davening, and she can't daven. She's not obligated to. So if so, she technically should be in the same situation. She should be after davening, so to speak, where she's permitted to eat. And if so, it's a zman, it's a time that she can have her suda. She should be obligated in Kiddush, and it should be asur for her to eat anything, even to take a drink of water, have a coffee, nothing. So if so, it's, why is it that we know, we all know, that very many women do eat. When they wake up, they say some sort of a bracha. They say either Berachas HaShachar, they say one bracha, a bakasha, whatever it is, and then they eat something. Why would they be permitted to do that? So if that we're talking about a woman who davens, she's already a bubby, she davens every day, she even goes to shul maybe, so yeah, then it's not a question that she's just like a man. So before she davens, she can eat, just like men can eat before they daven. But the question is, what if you're not planning on davening? If you're not planning on davening, why would it be permitted for you to eat before that? This is a question that many, many Paiskim discuss, and they try to find an explanation for this. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says that the explanation is that a woman really has an obligation to wait for her husband before she starts her Suda's Shabbos. She can't start her Suda's Shabbos without her husband. That's not right. And that being the case, so even though she's permitted to eat, but she can't really have her Suda yet. So since she can't have her Suda yet, until her husband comes home or until her husband finishes davening, so for her also, it is not considered Zman Suda. It's not considered the Zman Suda. So Rav Moshe goes on to say that there would be two limitations to this. He says, first of all, this only will help you if you haven't davened. In other words, the woman hasn't davened. But he says, if the woman has davened already, she can't say, okay, but my husband didn't finish davening yet, so I could eat. He says, no, we don't go so far. If you haven't davened and not planning on davening, and your husband hasn't finished davening yet, so then you can eat without Kiddush. But if you did daven, then you need to make Kiddush. The second thing he says is that this is a good explanation for a married woman. But what about a girl? A girl that's over bat mitzvah, so she can't eat without Kiddush, so she doesn't have to wait for anybody. So what is her excuse? So he says, she can't. She truly can't eat without Kiddush. So that, as we see, Rav Moshe's explanation is limited. It's limited to before the woman davens. That's okay, but it's also only to a married woman. Furthermore, Rav Shlomo Zalman disagrees with Rav Moshe, and he doesn't know where Rav Moshe got this idea from, that a woman has to wait for her husband in order to daven, in order to eat her seudah. It doesn't say anywhere that she has to wait for her husband. So what's the source for this obligation to wait for your husband to eat your seudah? So therefore, he rejects that, and he says, or Shlomo Zalman says, that truly, if a woman wants to eat before davening, so if she's going to daven, then that's fine. But if she's not going to daven, then she has no. Then she has to. She can't eat. She has to make kiddush before she is going to eat. So the bottom line is, there are other places that discuss this. And there's very often it's very difficult to make kiddush. So this is the way I think the proper approach should be. The proper approach should be that if you're planning on davening, then there's no problem. You can eat whatever it is you want to eat before davening, and then daven, and then obviously you'll wait to make to kiddush with your husband, or you'll make your own kiddush or whatever. If you're not planning on davening, so then ideally you should make kiddush. You can make kiddush either on grape juice, which is not a problem. Or you can make kiddush on coffee. The way to make kiddush on coffee would be to have it fill the coffee cup till the top, as it will be a becher, and let it cool off a little bit so that when you make the shahakal on it, you can drink a nice amount, a malay lugmav, which is a nice amount, or drink, you know, I guess 2 ounces worth of it, so that you could be yotze kiddush with that. That would be the right way to make kiddush on coffee. If that is also too difficult, if you're not up to drinking grape juice and you're not up to drinking coffee, and that's not an option, so there is what to rely on, especially if you're feeling weak and you need to eat, there is what to rely on, and you can eat without kiddush, especially if you want to rely on Rav Moshe, and do it before your husband finishes davening in shul, which would be around 10:30 if he starts at 8:30, it takes around 2 hours till davening is over. So that is the bottom line. So again, to summarize, ideally the best thing is that if you're not planning on davening, you should make kiddush before you eat. That would be the best thing to do. And you can do it either on grape juice or on coffee. But if not, if it's difficult and you're not feeling well, you can rely certainly on Rav Moshe and wait and up till 10:30. There's no problem with you eating before kiddush. Now, to move on to the parsha, this week's parsha told us, the famous story with Yaakov and Esav, dueling over the brachas that Yitzchak promised to give. And the truth is, there's a number of questions that can be discussed over here. I'm not going to talk about all of them. I'm just going to focus on one of them. I'm going to mention a few, perhaps ideas that you might want to speak about by your suda, with your guests, your husband, or with your children. It seems so strange that the way we're led to believe and the way we learned as children is that Yaakov Avinu was this obvious tzaddik and Esav was this obvious rasha. We painted a picture in grade school. He's this big guy, bulging muscles, walks around without a shirt, has tattoos all over him, and busy beating up people and killing people. And it's very hard to believe that if that's the situation, that Yitzchak would have been fooled into thinking that he was a tzaddik, obviously. I mean, no one would be fooled by that, blind or not blind. So that doesn't really make any sense, you know, once you think of it logically. And besides that, it's also hard to understand what happened over here. How is it that Yitzchak, so to speak, got fooled by Esav and Rivka didn't? Why was that? And why, how is it even possible to understand that Yitzchak got fooled? Yitzchak was a tzaddik yisrael elam. You can't fool a tzaddik like that. There is no such thing. They're beyond that. And they have Ruach HaKodesh. They can't be fooled. It's obvious that Yitzchak understood what Esav was all about. And yet he had a disagreement with Rivka how to approach it. And there's a very, very deep concept over here. How the disagreement between Rivka and Yitzchak, how to approach Esav, how to deal with him. And that very much was the center point of what was going on in this week's parasha. But I don't want to talk about that. That's a very long discussion. I want to talk about something else. Yaakov Avinu was told by his mother to steal the brachas. So he went in to Yitzchak. He dressed up like Esav. And his father says, who is this you, my son? And Yaakov answered, Anochi Esav Becharecha, I am Esav, your Bechar, your firstborn. And Rashi explains that what Yaakov was saying was like this, Anochi, I am who I am. And by the way, Esav Becharecha, Esav is your Bechar. So he sort of eluded lying by breaking it up that way. Then he continued to say, Yaakov continued to say, Asisi Kashati, Barta Tivesa, I did as you commanded. And Rashi explains, I've done your command many times in the past. This, in particular, that I'm doing now is not exactly your command, but I'm referring to the past. So this is very interesting. It seems to be presented as if this is a valid way, a legitimate way, to avoid telling a lie. Now, let's think about it. If you were to ask your son, Chaim, did you take a shower last night? And he says, of course I took a shower, and mutters under his breath a week ago. Would you say that's a lie, or that's he effectively managed to tell the truth? That's pretty much what Yaakov Avinu did. You find your son next to a wall, and it was scribbled all over with crayons and markers. And he said, Yitzchak, did you do this? And he says, I, and he says to himself, I'm Yitzchak, didn't do this. And, and divided up the sentence, and it means something else. So obviously, we all know, and it's clear, halachically, nothing to talk about, that it's 100% a lie. So what was going on over here? Yaakov did lie, so what was he trying to do? Why was he changing his words that way? What is he thinking to accomplish? And how did he lie? How did he go ahead and lie? So Yaakov Kamenetsky, in the Sefer Emes Yaakov, says that we have somewhat of a misconception of what is truth and what is sheker. What is emes and what is sheker, what is truth and what is falsehood. And let me first preface that Yaakov Kamenetsky was known to be the pinnacle of truth, to the point where he once was invited over to someone he had something to discuss with, and the person offered him some soup, and he had some question about this person's level of observance, and he wasn't sure if he could eat from him. But he didn't want to insult the person. So he told him, I don't eat soup. And from that day on, he did not eat soup again. That was his level of adherence to emes. So keeping that in mind, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky says that imagine you are standing on the street and a woman comes rushing by and hides in some bushes next to you. A minute later, a guy comes running, an evil-looking person holding a knife, and says, where'd she go? So he says, are you going to say, okay, the truth is she went into those bushes. I can't lie and point them in a different direction. So he says, no, that, to point him in the right direction and point him to the woman, that would be sheker. Because whatever is crooked, whatever lacks in yashrus, whatever is evil, is sheker. And to continue on that path is the definition of sheker, and emes is to avoid that. Yaakov Avinu was the true recipient of the brachas. Esav had sold him the bechira and sold him the right to these brachas. So therefore, he was the true recipient. Falsehood was that Esav should get it. Truth was Yaakov should get it. You can redefine what's truth and what's falsehood by what it's truly meant to be. The Gemara has an example of this. The Gemara says, someone buys a new dress, a new outfit, and comes and shows it to you, puts it on and shows it to you, says, how do you like it? How does it look on me? Now, they're not returning it, and they're not asking your advice, should they return it or not. They just want to hear, what do you think? How do I look? The Gemara says, regardless of what you think how she looks, you have to say, you look beautiful. And that's emes. That's not sheker. That's the truth. Because that is all she needs to hear, and that's all she wants to hear. And that being the case, that's what your opinion should be. That is the 100% truth. That truth and sheker is not defined by what we particularly think should be happening at the time or what actually happened, but rather what is meant to be and the way it's supposed to be. Now, if we're going to go down this road, this is a very slippery slope. Because now we can sort of justify anything we want to say. This is the right thing. All white lies have just been 100% accepted as mutter, as permitted. And think of where this would go if you'd be sitting in a court of law or in a bezdin, and you know you're right. You know, you know that that guy's stealing the money from you. So you'll say all sorts of lies to protect yourself and to win the case because, hey, you know, that's the truth. I'm the one who's entitled to the money. And so it's pretty simple that that would destroy all law and order. So how do we figure this out? So it's a very good question, and there's a lot to discuss. But we can learn a little bit from Yaakov Avinu. Did Yaakov Avinu go by himself and decide to take his brachas? No. He was aware of what Yitzchak was planning on doing. It wasn't a secret. He didn't do it until Rivka told him to do it. What happened when Rivka told him to do it? Either, like the Medrash says, she had Ruach HaKadosh. So now he knew that's what Hashem wanted. Or, like other Mepharshim say, she was an impartial person, an impartial viewer who gave him a true, that Torah opinion, what is the right thing here. He did not trust himself on this, even though he was the paradigm of Emes. And if there was anybody who was suited to decide what's truth and what's not, it was Yaakov Avinu. He did not trust himself. And that's a good lesson for ourselves as well. Whenever we're faced with a question of what to say and what not to say, what's truth and what's not truth, let's not trust ourselves. We're too negeh bedavar. It's too close to us, too hard for us to decide. Let's go out there. Let's ask our Rav, try to get that Torah. Let's ask a Rosh Hashiva. Let's ask a Rebbe. And if not, that's not available, let's ask someone impartial. And this way we can perhaps make the right decision about what's MS and what's Shek. So just to answer the original question, so then why was Yaakov changing his words? It was MS because this was the right thing to do. So then what's the point of changing your words? Just do it already. The answer is words are extremely, extremely powerful. I like the example I said before that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky said he doesn't eat soup, and then from then on he didn't eat soup. There is a certain power of words within themselves. Yaakov Avinu didn't want his words to be Shekha, even if what he was doing was lying, because he was deceiving Yitzchak. But he wanted at least his words shouldn't be Shekha. And that's another very, very important point. Our words are extremely powerful, and we have to take a lot of care that whatever words we say, they should be proper words, they shouldn't hurt people, and they shouldn't communicate the wrong thing, they shouldn't be insensitive, and so on and so forth. So the lesson we can take away from here is we have to break away from perhaps what we learned in school, that Yaakov Avinu has sort of this neat trick, how to get out of lying. And the answer is no. He was still lying. That wouldn't have helped lying. That wouldn't help anybody from lying. That would still be considered a lie. The reason why this wasn't a lie was because it was the right thing to do. And there are situations when it's the right thing to do that redefines what is emes and what is sheker. But at the same time, he didn't make that decision. He relied on Rivka, either the Ruach HaKodesh or on an impartial Das Torah or the Gedolei Hadar. Rivka was the tzaddikus of the Dar and relied on her Das Torah. And through that, it was able to make the decision what is emes and what is sheker. And from that, we should learn that's the only way we can approach such a question as well. And with all that, we should still try as much as possible to guard our words and make sure our words are as truthful as possible, regardless of what needs to be done. Have a good Shabbos, and I hope to hear some feedback. Again, please feel free to send questions now, especially for the next 20 minutes. And anytime, in any case, you can either text them or email them to me, and I'll try to answer them as quickly as possible. And feel free again to give suggestions for what the next year halacha topic should be about. Have a good night and have a good Shabbos. Kol Tov.